Welcome to WBAI. Noam Chomsky. First of all, what are your thoughts after the Iraqi elections? The initial enthusiasm seems to have dissipated a little bit, but what do you think?
Actually, my view is a little different than some of my friends. I think it was a very significant occasion. The crucial fact about the elections, which you can sort of pick up occasionally if you look at news reports carefully, the crucial fact is that the U.S. and, of course, Britain had to be brought to kicking and screaming into accepting elections. They didn't want them. The U.S. initially insisted that it write the Constitution, that it provide the legal system. When there was resistance on the part of Iraqis, I don't mean insurgents, I just mean nonviolent resistance, opposition, symbolized by Sistani, and they had to back down. They then tried to impose a kind of a caucus system that they could control. Once again, had to back down. Finally, they had to agree to elections, very reluctantly. It's a real triumph of nonviolent resistance, in my opinion. Next question will be whether they'll accede to the results. I mean, they're trying desperately not to, but that's the struggle right now.
Well, it looked like Cheney and Rumsfeld are out in the chat shows over the weekend trying to deny that some kind of theocratically flavored government would be taking hold in Iraq. What do you think of that?
Look, that's up to Iraqis. The crucial question for us is not whether they have a theocratic government. I'd personally prefer not, but you know, I can think of a lot of places where I'd prefer not, like here. The question is whether the U.S. will agree to let Iraq alone. That means to make it very clear and explicit, both in word and in action, that the U.S. will withdraw, set a timetable for it, will not influence what goes on in Iraq, will not leave military bases, will let the country go off on its own. I think we also ought to pay massive reparations, but you know, stop short of that. Those are the crucial issues. It's not up to Rumsfeld with what kind of government they have. It's up to him to get out.
Can we start thinking of the United States as having lost the war in Iraq?
I don't think so. You know, I also don't think it lost the war in Vietnam. It's almost impossible for a huge superpower to lose a war against a virtually defenseless antagonist. The U.S. could be compelled, but that means by us, to withdraw from its initial war aims. It'd be very hard. I mean, it's extremely hard to imagine that the U.S. would ever permit a sovereign, independent Iraq. Just consider what its policies are likely to be. I mean, look, an independent Iraq, really independent, without the U.S. controlling it in one or another way, if it's even minimally democratic, will have a Shiite majority. One of the first things they'll do is to try to restore closer relations with Iran, and not because they love Iran particularly, they don't, but because they'd rather have amicable than conflicted relations with a powerful neighbor. Iranian, that's the last thing the U.S. wants. Those moves could very likely stir up some moves towards autonomy in the neighboring Shiite regions of, largely Shiite regions of Saudi Arabia, which happens to be where almost all the oil is. We're now making up a scenario which is not so implausible, which would lead to a Shiite alliance independent of the United States controlling the major oil resources in the world. Iraq, if at all independent, would be likely to regain its move to regain its natural place as a leading state in the Arab world, you know, something that goes back to biblical times. That would mean that it would rearm. It would confront the regional enemy. It might well develop weapons of mass destruction as if only as a deterrent, and we can continue. But is the U.S. going to sit by and watch any of this? I mean, talk about a sovereign, independent Iraq when it comes from somebody like Rumsfeld or Cheney is a joke. They don't have the slightest intention of that. It's possible that a combination of Iraqi resistance, and again, I mean the very effective nonviolent resistance, which has been the important part, combination of that with internal activism and pressures in the United States and its British lackey could move in that direction, but it's going to take a lot of work. I mean, look, Tony Blair immediately, first thing he said is clear, open, direct, there will be no timetable for a withdrawal. Pretty much the same was said in Washington with the usual meaningless flourishes about, of course, we'll do what they want.
On the other hand, the Bush administration seems to be having a rather difficult time in subduing Iraq. They may not want to sit back and have the country become a sovereign entity, but on the other hand, they're having a pretty hard time getting it to do its bidding. So, what do you see happening?
Well, there are two kinds of hard time that they're having. One is controlling the insurgency. The other is beating back the mass popular nonviolent resistance, which forced them into elections. Force the U.S. into elections. And in my opinion, it's the second that's more important. I mean, my guess is they can probably crush the insurgency just because of the distribution of force. But I don't think that's the basic problem they have.
Now, you keep underscoring the importance of the nonviolent resistance. What should American opponents of American imperial adventures, what kind of attitude should we take towards this insurgency? Is it not our concern? Should we be appalled by its indiscriminate violence? Or how should we think about this?
I mean, I think murdering Iraqi Union leaders is criminal, for example. And a lot of what the insurgents have done is criminal. But you rank the priorities. Our priority is to stop major war crimes, like Fallujah, for example. So, yeah, what the resistance is doing is, one can also criticize harshly, in fact, but that's in any kind of ranking, even if we were on Mars, and certainly if we're in the United States, what's vastly more important is our own crimes, which are much worse than they're ours.
Now, what do you think of the future plans of the Bush administration? Seymour Hersh has been reporting a great lust to go after Iran next. Some people doubt that. What do you think the Bushies have in mind?
Frankly, I doubt that they can answer that question. It depends on a lot of circumstances. But fact of the matter is that for the last, if they were intending to bomb it or to attack Iran, they wouldn't have been announcing it for the last couple of years, in my opinion. Announcing loud and clear, as they've been doing for several years, that they're planning an attack on Iran simply induces the Iranians to respond by dispersing targets and other defensive measures. If they wanted to attack, they'd attack. My guess, and remember, this has been going on for years. I mean, for some years now, according to unquestionable reports, I mean, like, from the military, the U.S. has been providing Israel with over 100 advanced jet bombers, very loudly proclaiming that they are capable of bombing Iran and returning, and are updated versions of the jet bombers that were used by Israel to attack the Iraqi reactor. They've also announced that they're equipping them with what are called special weapons, which are purposely unidentified, so that for the ears of Iranian intelligence. Later they added that they may be supplying bunker busters also. All of this is, and I suspect whatever Cy Hirsch is reporting is simply more of this. My own guess is that the intention, very clear intention of all of this, is to rattle the Iranian leadership, to provoke them into actions of which will, first of all, be repressive within Iran, and will therefore contribute to the ongoing efforts to subvert Iran from within, which are almost certainly going on, and will also scare off the Europeans. In fact, there was a interesting story in the Wall Street Journal just a couple of days ago, which described, didn't put it in these terms, but effectively described the success of this strategy. Major European firms like Krupp and Tyson in Germany and others, really major ones, are backing off from Iran. For one thing, because everybody's scared to death of the United States and doesn't want to irritate it for understandable reasons. and for another because they're afraid of what the consequences would be. I mean, if there actually were an attack, they don't want to take a chance. Well, that's of major importance to the U.S. The U.S. has been trying very hard to isolate Iran. Nobody else wants that, even U.S. oil companies. The rest of the world has been evading it in one way or another. Japan made a attempted to make a huge contract to develop a huge contract to establish a huge contract to develop the Iranian oil fields. They've apparently backed off. China's proceeding and are not backing off. India really recently proceeded. Europe has substantial investments there. It's all undercutting the U.S. effort to isolate Iran. Well, how do you scare people off? By threatening to invade.
What about the broad project? It wasn't all that long ago we were hearing about how we were now had come out of the closet as an imperialist power and we're puffing our chests out about it. What about that project? Is it derailed? Is it in the shop for a tune-up? Are they rethinking?
Well, I think they must be rethinking. For one thing, the failure in Iraq is just colossal. I mean, almost nobody can understand it. My own guess, Frank, no military expert, was that the so-called war would be over in about 3 days and that they would have absolutely no problem controlling any resistance. I mean, the country was being held together with scotch tape. It was totally defenseless. Otherwise, they'd never have attacked it. The country's been devastated by sanctions. The U.S. moves in. They get rid of the sanctions regime, which was destroying the country. They get rid of Saddam Hussein, making most people very happy. They've got huge resources to reconstruct the country. They've totally failed all across the board. They're having more trouble in Iraq than the Germans had in occupied Europe. If the partisans hadn't had outside support, they'd have been crushed quickly. It's just astonishing what the failures have been.
Well, what's the problem? Is it a military thing? Is it political, cultural, strategic? What?
I was talking to about a year ago to a high official of one of the major relief organizations. I don't want to identify him, but very important one. He's been a high official. He's been all over the world and some of the worst places. And he had just come back from Baghdad for a short visit, and I asked him why he thought it was such a total catastrophe. And he said, I'm quoting him, he said he had never seen such a combination of arrogance, ignorance, and incompetence. He said they just can't do anything right. And you can see it by looking at the day-to-day activities. It's been outlandish. The behavior of the troops, it's not their fault. It's the way they're trained. It's the way they're directed. The operations that have been undertaken. The inability to get the electricity system back together. I don't even think it's at pre-war levels at this point.
That is incompetence. There's not some grand strategic design that we can't figure out behind it.
I don't think so. I think we should not underestimate it. I think he was right. It's a combination of extreme arrogance, incompetence, which goes along with it, and just ignorance. The Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz types think that they can just steamroller over everything. What do they have to understand?
What about the domestic side of things? The yellow ribbons have faded and fallen off a lot of trees by now, and that initial extreme enthusiasm for the war has completely dissipated. The polls are turning against Bush, not very heavily, but are turning against him. Can he pursue this kind of aggressive foreign policy with so little domestic support?
Well, first of all, I don't think there was a lot of domestic support in the first place. I mean, if you look back at the polls, which I've been following pretty closely, in September 2002, that's when they virtually announced the invasion, along with the national security strategy. That was combined with a huge government media propaganda campaign to try to terrify the population here into believing that Saddam Hussein was an imminent threat to survival. And in fact, it was fairly successful. Within a couple of weeks, the U.S. was driven completely off the international spectrum. It's the only country in the world where people literally regarded Iraq as a threat. And every, you know, he may have been hated in Iran and Kuwait and elsewhere, but they weren't afraid of him. But about 60% of Americans at that point did think that Saddam Hussein was an imminent threat. He was threatening us with weapons of mass destruction. He was tied up with Al-Qaeda. Maybe he was involved in 9/11, planning more attacks and so on. And those attitudes were very closely correlated with support for war, which is not in the least surprising. If I believed those things, I'd have been in favor of it too. And it's more or less persisted. It's pretty remarkable. If you go up till today, I won't run through the details. If you go up till today, about 75% of the population think it was it would be wrong to have attacked Iraq if it did not have weapons of mass destruction and it did not have ongoing links to terror. Well, you know, we know that both of those claims are totally false. I mean, they've been exploded even by the government's own commissions. Nevertheless, 50% of the population still believe them. And if you pay attention, you can see why. Just at the Rice confirmation hearings, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist repeated them. Said we had to attack Iraq because of its weapons of mass destruction and ties to terror. Well, you know, people don't do research projects. They can't make subtle judgments about that. As long as they can keep a large part of the population frightened with hysterical charges, they may be able to continue the policies. Actually, it's quite the same on the domestic front. I mean, take a look at this Social Security scam. They have succeeded amazingly in convincing a fair part amount of the population, including younger people, that there's some terrible fiscal crisis in Social Security, which is total fabrication. But they've succeeded, and with media support, you know, it all gets repeated soberly.
How does the state and the trajectory of public opinion now around Iraq compare with the Vietnam War?
I don't think those comparisons are very close. I mean, Iraq was invaded in March 2003, right? Vietnam was invaded by John F. Kennedy in 1962. It was 4 or 5 years before there was even a whisper of protest. And by then, South Vietnam was practically wiped out. Finally, large-scale protest began around 66, 67 or so. And it was very strong for a while, and by 1969, about 75% of the population, 70% I guess it was, of the population, regarded the Vietnam War as, the words of the polls are, fundamentally wrong and immoral, not a mistake. That's around 70% of the population, and that figure remains pretty constant, close to the present, and it was almost none of the articulate opinion. I mean, articulate opinion was ranged between, hawks who said we should not fight with one arm behind our backs, and doves who said it's costing us too much, so let's get out. But that's not what the population thought. Well, you know, that's Vietnam, and the way it's been reconstructed, that's all there is. So, a couple of New York Times, a week or two ago. Review article on Vietnam and Iraq, in which they gave the opinions on Vietnam within that spectrum. Not one word suggesting there's anything wrong with wiping out, with attacking a country, wiping it out, killing a couple million people, leaving it utterly devastated, using chemical warfare, which killed who knows how many people and is still doing it. That's not even an option. Well, in the case of Iraq, there's been a lot more protest than that, and much earlier. I mean, after all, Iraq was the first war in U.S., or for that matter, European history that I can recall. First time that a war was massively protested before it was even officially launched. Not 4 or 5 years later when the victim was practically wiped out, as in the Vietnam case. So I just don't think comparisons mean very much. The wars are very different. The reactions were quite different. The population is much less willing to accept aggression today than it was then. I mean, in the early 60s when they were wiping out South Vietnam, you know, there was barely any pretense, and nobody pretended that Vietnam is a threat to us. In the case of Iraq, the only way to get any support was to concoct fantastic stories about Iraq, just about to destroy us. It's quite a different situation.
There has been, over the last several years, well, actually since 9/11, tremendous concern about the state of civil liberties in this country. Most recently, we've seen this firestorm directed against Ward Churchill for his rather intemperate essay. What do you think of the state of civil liberties? Are they really seriously under threat, or are they too deeply ingrained that we shouldn't be too alarmed about that?
We should always be alarmed about it. I mean, frankly, I don't think they're under great threat, but I think they are under very severe attack. I mean, there's a kind of a totalitarian mentality that is not insignificant, that is trying very hard to crush independent thought. It's not just Ward Churchill. The Middle East profession is under very severe attack, slanders, lies, and so on. There's an attempt to control the universities. I think over 20 state legislatures are now considering legislation, which I think is inspired by David Horowitz, to essentially control what teachers say, teach, and so on, under the pretext that they're all a bunch of commie rats who are indoctrinating students. This is threatening, but I personally think it'll be resisted. However, that's really up to us to determine, not to speculate about.
Finally, I've always been curious about how your colleagues in the administration at MIT treat you and react to your political work. I mean, you're at MIT for a very different business than politics, but what's it like there for you?
You know, MIT has been very good about all this. I mean, now it's not an issue, but in the 1960s, as it happens in the 1960s, I was in a laboratory which was 100% funded by the armed services. And in fact, MIT altogether at that time was, don't remember the numbers, but maybe 90% Pentagon funded. I was very actively organizing resistance, very publicly. I was in and out of jail. I was facing a potential pretty long jail sentence, which might have gone through, except that the trials were canceled after the Tet Offensive. I was speaking all over the place. It couldn't have been more public. It was as public as I could make it. But there wasn't any pressure whatsoever from the administration. I'm sure they were getting plenty of flack from alumni and others, but I never heard of that.